Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting with Sarah Dooley. And we're across from Kate Morton, who's coming to talk about Clockmaker's Daughter. I cannot believe you're here. Thank you very much for coming.
Very exciting for us.
And for me, it's a real pleasure.
We were so sad when you up and left and went to the UK, and we hadn't had a visit. And this is our first visit with you, and it's absolutely wonderful. And the news just keeps getting better and better with your writing career and with this book. Both of us have, I'm halfway through, and don't you dare and miss spoiler here.
I just finished it.
No spoilers in this podcast. I suppose the first thing is, are you enjoying life in that cold and miserable island?
Well, you have to understand that we're in the middle of a heat wave over there at the moment. A heat wave of at least 31 degrees Celsius, Which, you know, is baking. So the roads are melting.
How are people cooking?
We're being reminded to drink a lot of water. It's very helpful.
Are you going out in the street going, I'm an expert. Anyone need advice?
Relax, everybody. It's all going to be okay.
I live my life in Queensland. I know how to cope.
Exactly. That's what I keep saying. At least it's not humid. Come on. Toughen up. No, it's great. I mean, and I do feel I get the best of both worlds because I get to be between. So I'm over there, which, particularly writing Clockmaker's Daughter was incredible because I was able to actually, for the first time ever, be on site when I was writing, obviously it's such an ordinary thing to say that being there really does help with research, but it's not the big things, it's the small things, things that you wouldn't even think to research that you can observe through living and being. And so that has been just the most wonderful opportunity. But I'm back here pretty regularly. I think I came back 5 times last year, so I do feel I've got a foot in both camps.
And we'll sort of touch on it earlier when we were having a chat. But I feel there's a deep link with me because I spent so long in a dusty secondhand bookshop reading old English classics to England. And when I go there, I feel like it's part of home. Do you have that experience when you spend time in England?
Yeah, absolutely. And for very similar reasons, I think, that when I was growing up, I mean, the book that turned me into a reader was Enid Blyton's The Enchanted Wood. I was given a copy when I was 4 years old, and I lived with those children. You know, that cottage on the edge of the deep, dark woods and the little creek they had to jump across, and the whoosh, whoosh, whoosh of the trees. That, I just tumbled in there and it became a real world. And so I am convinced that the books that you read as a child become a part of you. You know, they become a part of the landscape of your life. And so for me, the very first time I went to England, I was 17 years old, and I knew it. It wasn't a culture shock at all. The landscape, it was a part of me already, in the same way that the real geographical landscape of my childhood is a part of me.
And do you find your I don't know what it is within a novelist, but that fictional part of your brain drifts there?
Yeah, it does, for whatever reason. I used to think maybe it was because I lived in the subtropics, and I'm not great with heat. I mean, for all that I joke about the English heat wave, I'm not great with heat either. And so growing up in the subtropics, particularly in Brisbane, because I lived as a child on Tambourine Mountain, which is reliably 5 degrees cooler than down on the flats. So Brisbane was really hot for me for at least 5 months of the year. And so I would often in my imagination go somewhere where, you know, the you're inside and the snow is kissing the glass and the fire's crackling in the grate. It's definitely a way of traveling, in your mind.
Well, I couldn't imagine The Clockmaker's Daughter set anywhere else. For the people listening, I mean, we've had you for a few hours now. We've been lucky enough to hang out with you for a while. We've spoken about your book. But for the people listening, can we tell them a bit about The Clockmaker's Daughter and just what it's about and where you got this idea from?
Sure can. So The Clockmaker's Daughter is, at its heart, it's a mystery story, but it's set within a big, beautiful old house on the upper reaches of the River Thames in England. The storyteller has a very interesting vantage point, and it has lots of different characters whose stories thread together across time. So the main story, I suppose, opens in 1862 when a group of young artists, quite reminiscent of the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, decide to flee London and escape to the countryside for a summer of creativity. And they're imagining, you know, picnics and painting and poetry. But of course, because it's fiction, things don't turn out that way. All goes horribly wrong. And on one sort of cracking hot summer's afternoon, a gunshot rings out. One woman is killed and another one disappears. And the truth of what really happens that day slips through the cracks of time. Cue music, so cue sound effects. And then 150 years later, a young archivist in London discovers a satchel that's been lost, and inside it are two objects. One is a photograph of a bewitching Victorian woman, and the other is a sketch of a house which looks curiously familiar to her and reminds her of a story that her mother used to tell her about a house out in the countryside.
It's such a magical story, and listening, and it's so fresh in my mind because I literally just read it, and just hearing you do the setup gave me shivers. But, you know, there's so much about this is to do with the passage of time and how history changes, and I think there's a line in here about how the truth depends on who's telling the story. And I'm just getting off track now because I'm just raving.
I'm marveling at just how many novels are in the one novel, because you do, these characters have their own setting, time, scene, their own backstory. This seems like a lot of extra work for a novelist.
Even though we only get like sometimes little snippets of that backstory, it seems fully formed.
It seems to go, yeah.
It's just a few strokes. I don't know how you do it.
It's like I couldn't pick my favourite historical period and went, I'm just going to put them all in there. But one of my obsessions as a writer and as a person too is time. I think about it a lot, the way it feels, our experience of time, memory, the way all of our memories are instant in a way, because you can call them to mind, you know, one after the other, even though they're all out of sequence. So that's, I think, where the structure of my books comes from. It's always an attempt to juxtapose different times across one another. And The Clockmaker's Daughter, you know, the title sort of gives it away, takes that one step further. So we have the one storyteller, almost like the voice of the house, who has seen everything that's unfolded from the 1860s up to the present day. And then interspersed are different short stories, I guess, following the lives of a few of the people who've lived in the house. And of course, because they have to, all of these storylines weave together to tell and to reveal the answer to the central mystery.
And because it's a Kate Morton novel, there will be a lot of, like, surprises and people who, you know, turn out to be connected in ways that you would never imagine.
Of course.
And things that, you know, seem to happen and then they didn't happen that way. And whenever I'm reading one of your books, I always wonder, do you plan this all out? Because it's so complex and there's so many moving parts. Do you have to plot the whole thing before you start writing, or does it just sort of happen?
Yeah, moving parts like inside a clock.
Wow, yeah.
I do, broadly speaking. So for me, there's three parts of writing a book. There's the planning, the writing, and the editing. And the writing's my least favorite part. And my most favorite part, I think, is the planning, the dreaming at the beginning. And for me, it's months and months where all the little ideas and things I've seen and heard and felt and wondered about that I store in my mind or in my notebook all start to come together, and a few of them join up and a picture forms, and then I scribble around that. And at some point there's this compulsion to start writing, and I absolutely have to do it, and I can't get there to the keyboard fast enough, because that's when I switch from pen, because I can type faster when I want to actually write. And so I have a pretty good idea of the shape and the idea and the structure and some of the characters. I mean, Juliet was with me from the start, and for a long time I thought she was going to be, that the story would only have two timelines and she would be a much bigger part. But then that changed in that early planning period. And then with this book, for the first time, I wrote completely out of sequence insofar as chapter one through to, you know, the end of the book. And I had all of the historical periods open in different documents at the one time, and I would sort of duck and weave between them. And that really worked for me because the effect that I wanted to create, which is almost as if the layers of time are happening concurrently, I wrote it in that way. So each of them is as alive for me as the other, and I hope it's that way when a reader is there, whether you're in 1928 or 1940 or 1899, it should feel immediate.
Yeah, I was never confused as well. I think when you're reading a book and you're, you know, flying through it, and like there's often a thing at the beginning of the chapter to just signal where we are, like I don't remember ever paying attention to that. I would just go straight into the next chapter and know where I was, which is quite extraordinary considering the number of different time periods and characters that you are juggling.
I'm really glad that you had that experience, because I do understand that for some people that's not necessarily the way they like to read a novel. Mm-hmm. For me, I really love that, and I as a reader, I mean, not as a writer about my own work, I'm quite happy to follow where the writer goes and to jump back and forth. So I'm really glad that when you read it, it felt that way.
Mm. I was thinking about the construction side of things, and I felt like a weaver and trying to work out how you're doing it and having these things and knowing that this bit will have an effect here, like, and so far off in a different part of the book. And it did seem like a juggling game, but your explanation about having them all open at once makes so much sense now. I mean, it just seems like you're kind of more like spinning plates.
Yeah.
And they're all going at the one time.
Yeah, and you run over to another one and then back to this one. Yeah.
To keep it all going, because when as a reader, stepping back from how did the hell did she do this, and just being the reader guy, you know, it is seamless. And that little tiny shift, and I was talking before about it, you know, when you do shift in time, there's a tiny shift in the way you're writing that kind of echoes the writing of the time. And so then you get this, that's why I think you have that easy ability to sort of shift down into this period for this two chapters and then in a moment flick back to 1862 because there's a different style going on. And are you aware of this, or is this something that's unconscious?
That's a huge compliment to me, because that's really important to me, that I guess it's the verisimilitude of the character. You know, if a woman is a young working mother in 1940, then she should sound that way. You know, she should speak in the same rhythms and patterns that a woman of that period would have spoken. And, you know, similarly, 1928, you know, it's different. The sensibility is different. And so I always think that's a huge part of my job as a writer, is to try and, as best I can, as a woman writing in 1718, capture that. So a lot of the research that I do isn't for the larger picture items. It's about the characters and what they might be thinking and feeling and how they might express those things. Because I think that's the sort of thing as a reader that does make the character ring true. You know, we all somehow know, you know, for whatever reason, we have an unconscious store of these knowledges already. And so for me, it's very important to distinguish the characters and make sure they fit within the socio-historical, whatever period in which they're positioned.
So you're able to hit those points with readers out there. And I mean, your success is astonishing. Like, it is a massive success. For an Australian writer to conquer the world as you've done is just brilliant. Brilliant for all the Australian writers left here who can see that there's a pathway to go as well. But just to be able to go to England, tell their stories better than theirs telling themselves their own stories, and to connect...
You're making us so uncomfortable.
and connect with these people in all these different countries all around the world, like 30-something countries or something. It's
huge.
It is amazing. And it's beyond me to even try to work out what it is that appeals in these books, what the little bit is that each of these readers around the world just warms to these books and they reread them. Like, they reread, and you must get people lined up with scuffed old copies of favorite books.
You saw it here today.
I love that. People always apologize. And I'm like, no, that's my favorite kind of book to see, the ones that they've fallen in the bath and they've been dried in front of the heater and people have dropped coffee on them. I love that.
Well, we were talking earlier, the relationship between your favorite book and the thing you read, like the actual copy you read, it ties into the sort of things you write about because of the relationship with people and objects, houses, necklaces, photos.
Little drawings. Houses on the edge of deep dark woods.
Yes.
It's still happening.
Yeah. There's something that we imprint upon an object for it.
Definitely.
That is a relationship between us and it.
Definitely. And do you know what? Even more than the content of books and the story that's inside them, the thing that I think if what you're sort of asking there is why do people respond to the books? Because, I get asked that quite a lot. But and I can only go on what people tell me. And I think people say, and what I think it is people like to feel about books the way they did when they were a child and they read. You know that feeling when you open a book and you're not seeing black marks on white page, you're just disappearing and you're down the rabbit hole and you are completely living inside that world and your parents could be calling you to do things, but you can't even hear them because it is 100% vivid and alive and you are in that book. Mm. And I think adults should get to feel that way too. And I certainly, as when I'm writing, that's how it is for me. I completely live inside the world. And my greatest hope is that that's what people respond to when they are reading my books and enjoy them, is I just hope, even if it makes you feel a fraction of that envelopment of being a child and reading and sort of being inside that story, then that's, the most I could hope for.
I think it is that. It's magical. It's the magic of good storytelling. Plus, every book of yours I've ever read, I've come away with the feeling of, and I don't know if this is sort of purposeful, but I think it's always because it's the passage of time always, and there's like history and like events that happened in the past echo through, and even if they get forgotten for a while, like it's comforting to think that our lives matter and that the things that we do now could have an echoing effect on people that we couldn't imagine, years from now.
That's
a magical idea. And that combined with like these beautiful houses and like places that you create and characters, like, I don't know. I think it's little wonder that people respond to it all over the world.
And there's also there's a tone that you use often when you're in the directing mode, which has that kind of, now let me tell you a story.
Yeah.
That feel. And then that sort of gets us in the mood. Like, it's like,
especially in this book, I want to say chief narrator, I suppose, of this book is like, one of the best I've come across. I really, really, really like her.
Oh, I'm so
and
glad.
I feel like I can't even talk about her because even just like there's spoilers just in the name that I would use.
because she does have a very special vantage point. Mm. She's seen a lot and can comment on an awful lot.
Yeah, but there's a character in the book. I'm not telling you if it's the chief narrator or not. It's just a character in this book that, other people learn about long after they are gone. I'm being so careful. Do you notice how careful I am not to spoil? But, a lot of people fall in love with this character in a way, that I think the reader does as they're reading. And, like, I just wondered, is that how it was for you? I felt that she reminded – okay, so now I'm just –
I love watching you trying not to do spoilers.
It's something that's really clear in this is just how much you feel for the characters. That comes across so clearly.
And I'm so glad.
And that's what involves us in it, because you're involved in it.
Yeah.
And you pass that straight on to us. And their involvement in each other, the way that they're crossing time. It does.
I'm so glad you feel that, because I always think that – readers, and I say this as a reader too, you can tell when a writer is invested, I guess. Mm. And so, I'm very glad you felt that.
Well, it rings true in a way that I found myself questioning, because I've read other books, about pre-Raphaelite painters and stuff, and Lizzie Siddal and the models that inspired them and stuff. And I found myself, like, actually wanting to just Google that, just to, like, be sure that this wasn't a real painter, because it had that sort of ring of truth.
Oh, I'm glad.
Like, you know, it feels like it could be based on a real thing.
Yeah. Oh, I'm really glad.
Well, this ties into one of the questions I like to always get to ask when I have someone who's so brilliant at doing this, you know, writing novels, is how do you, like, what are the things that you tell writers when you get a chance, or budding writers or emerging writers? What are the things? Because one of the things that just came across to me then is you've got to believe it. And that to me seems like the lesson told.
Yeah, if you could just spell it out for people how you do this, that would be amazing.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that is crucial, that you have to believe it. And you know, as a writer, when you're writing something that's not, you don't quite believe it, you know it, you know the feeling, it doesn't feel right. And I guarantee you a reader will notice that too, you know. And so for me, I'm a very hard taskmaster. For me, once I hand over the first draft, that's, I mean, the real work is about to begin. I mean, my first draft is you know, it's decent, but I, in structural edit, almost take it apart again and really put a lot of pressure on myself to put it back together the best way I can. And I think it is that it's, if you think something's not working quite well enough, then it's not. Mm-hmm. And you know it. You know, you can tell, oh, it's okay, I'll just put a bit of masking tape over here and, you know, a few leaves over the hole. Nobody will notice.
Are you doing that? Are you alone doing the structural edit? Do you do that by yourself, or do you?
I get a reader's report from my editor, but I've always done my own as well. Yeah. So, you know, I'll look at the things that they've said. I'll go, yep, yes, agree, yes, I have to fix that, I have to fix that. And then I look at the enormous list of my own, my self-critique, which is enormous, and set to work on that. But I'm quite, I guess, a perfectionist.
Yeah.
So I do put a lot of time into that.
I remember when Matt Riley hit the scene and everyone started to write those books. You know, I can do that. And some of them just bombed, like, one after the other. And the one thing you can tell with Matt Riley is he digs that stuff.
Yeah,
like
there's no
fake in it.
Yeah.
You know? And all these fakers came out. And in your wake, too, because you were such a... That just came out of... Suddenly Kate Bond was everywhere. And this book did so well. And so everyone's like, right, that direction. And they had all these copycats that came onto the market.
It's such a funny thing, because when I was writing The Shifting Fog, I'd written a couple of manuscripts beforehand. And I guess to learn how to write, I'd sort of looked at what was selling and what was out there, and I'd gone, all right, well, I'll write a book like that. And I actually, to teach myself, looked and sort of pulled apart the structure and went, oh, okay, so you do it like that. And I wrote these manuscripts, and they were okay, but they weren't publishable or published. And then I'd become a bit disheartened. And by the time I started writing The Shifting Fog, I'd had a baby, and I'd really come to terms with the fact that, well, I'm not going to be a published writer, so I'm just going to write something for me with all the really incredibly uncool, various things that interest me in it. So, you know, it's going to have sort of upstairs, downstairs. I mean, who was into that? This is pre-Downton Abbey.
Yeah.
You know, it was so specific. All these things. You know, my nana was a shorthand expert. Oh, that would be a cool way to, you know, do this. I'll put that in. And I wrote it. And I actually said to my husband when I was about halfway through, thank God I'm writing this just for me, because there's no one else on earth who is into this. You know, what kind of book is it even? It's not a mystery. It's not a romance. It's not historical exactly, because it's sort of in the present as well. Oh, well, you know. And so, you know, by and by, I guess it did have love in it. And also, there's always an element of luck.
Yeah.
You know, my timing, without realizing it, I happened to write something that, you know, people wanted to read at that exact moment. And that's luck.
Yeah. But I think the kernel there is, again, you're doing...
You
really believed in.
I think so. People say write what you know, but it's write what you love.
Yeah.
You know, you can always research the bits you don't know.
Yeah.
That's such a good quote. Write what you love.
Yeah, I've got to put that in the blog now.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I mean, you still, truthfulness is important, you know, at being true to you and what you love. And so I guess that's what you know, but yeah, write what you love.
Okay. It's been such a pleasure talking to you. Sarah and I would like this podcast to go on.
Yeah, I'm giving dagger eyes right now. Yeah, like, we're ending now? Can we just stop?
No. I can pull back a bit if you've got another question you want to slip in there.
We could go all day.
Yeah. Kate, thank you so much for coming in.
A complete pleasure. As you know, I asked if I could come. Woo-hoo, yay. Thank
you
for having me.
We're so glad you
do. We're so glad. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you can get hold of The Clockmaker's Daughter at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.